swing a line on some tree and some bark. I got some trees just to spark, and I don't care. There is a million of y'all. Kamikaze, it don't mean on your sockers. Got the blade, guillotine on the mark. Out in a blaze, I feel so amazing. Who try to play me?
Expecting a trick when it comes to cargo. Inspecting this pack, the name's Marlo. Requesting in bricks just to make the car load. Flex from my whip, meet at Ricardo's. I got a big slick ride, and she looks like a flick. Like my nemesis, real hot and thick. Like an ass with a waist, and she act real slick. Trick me thrice like you got a damn lick. I'm gonna say it like I got a big dick. He might react like he ain't worth shit. I'm at the bank with a mask like I'm sick. I bought a bag and let's fill it up quick. I'm gonna light up your silly little clique. Call me a terror when I come for your gig. A Ricard, hand me the stick. Burn it all down with a brick. Exit the castle with a pick. I eat your body with a flick. I'm deep in the jungle, so impolitic. Deep in the jungle, I'm plotting. Shoot your best shots at me, I'm feeling nothing. My stripes and my scales are alarming. Bitch, I'm deep in the jungle, you try your disarming. Bitch. Bitch, bitch. You look crimson, eyes like a blitzen. He move like a vixen. Head ducked down from the piston. House of munition. I flipped his dick with conviction. We kept it slick and seditious. We kept it slick and seditious.
Wow, what a collaboration. That was Cartel Madras featuring Backwash, the collaboration of My Dreams. They both have such powerful sounds. I'm so glad they came together to make that track, Deep in the Jungle, which is off of Cartel Madras's brand new album, The Serpent and the Tiger. It's the third installment of the Project Gunda trilogy. Before that, I played Bernice. It was the Eve Jarvis remix of their track, Empty Cup. It is 6:02. I've gone over. Good thing there's no one in the studio after me. Thank you so much for tuning into Deliberate Noise today. Tune in again next Monday at 5 for more Deliberate Noise. If you ever want to let me know that your band is playing a show, or if you want to send me your music, or just tell me what you're listening to these days, you can always contact me by email, ninapanini1234@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you heard something today that you've never heard before. Enjoy your last couple weeks of summer, and I'll be back with a new episode in 2 weeks' time. You can listen to past podcasts at citr.ca. Just look up Deliberate Noise. I'm going to end with a track from Philadelphia's Gosh. That's spelled G-H-O-S-H. They're a grime band. They have a new release, Alien Nation. Here is their single, Bang This, on CITR 101.9 FM.
Bang, this is dangerous. When I 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 bang, this is dangerous. When I
you ain't no punk, you pump. 808 with the groove in your butt. Turn down for what? I'm the queen of scum, bitch. We only do spooky stuff. I'm like, boo hollers, you wanna be my psych? Not touches, hammer time, rules of plenty.
Bang! You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Nisiyam, Nisiyaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiyam, Nisiyaya, and the Sakhulia, Talitin, Homasqueam, Mustayo.
Hello, you're currently listening to the Orca Man podcast on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded Musqueam territory on the University of British Columbia.
This episode is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
In today's episode, I'm talking with Terrence Scarfe of the Marine Mammal Research Unit at UBC, where she is doing her master's research on transient killer whales populations around the area. Now, you might have seen some videos of killer whales punting seals 80 feet into the air or ruining some other whale's day. Now, that would be the transient orcas, our resident orcas here in the Pacific Northwest, specifically like fish, but we'll get into a little bit more about that in the episode. Taryn is once again a master's student within the Marine Mammal Research Unit, and last year, as well as the year previous, went on two expeditions throughout the Salish Sea, gathering data with her supervisors and other members of the Marine Mammal Research Unit and NOAA. Which research will be coming out soon. I'm very excited to end up seeing that. But without further ado, let's get into the episode. All right. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Orca Man podcast. This is Orca Man here, Fred. And today I'm here with Taryn Scarfe. And Taryn, I'll let you introduce yourself.
Hi. My name is Taryn. I am a master's student at the University of British Columbia. I'm in the Marine Mammal Research Unit, and I'm currently studying transient killer whales.
Woohoo! The MMRU. I was gonna say, I always love when you see acronyms and actually, rather than like being short and actually set out, it's 90% of it is just understanding like what half the stuff is. I remember entering UBC and it was like LFS. I'm like, what the hell is that?
I know, so many acronyms around UBC, and it's confusing because, so there's the Marine Mammal Research Unit, MMRU, but then in Vancouver, there's also Marine Mammal Rescue, which is just MMR.
Okay.
So having to discern between MMR and MMRU can be confusing.
Well, I totally, because you posted some of their stuff that they've been putting up, because I know that they had, like, there's a Marine Mammal Rescue, like, show, or, like, they have a, like, they're featured on one or something like that.
Yeah, so I volunteer at Marine Mammal Rescue. I did a practicum there during my undergrad. And so they, last summer, during COVID and everything, they recorded a TV show called Wild Pacific Rescue. So there's only three episodes. It was just like a limited series. Hopefully it'll be picked up for more, but yeah, it's really cool. Just kind of followed them around through some disentanglements with like sea lions, day-to-day stuff that happens at the rescue center. So it's mainly harbor seals that come in.
Fair.
And yeah, it's really interesting and to be able to show people what I do there. And I talk about it a lot, but it's nice for them to actually see it, right?
Well, I can only imagine, like, people are sitting down. I'm like, oh, so you just like you take straws out of turtles' mouths. Like, that's gotta be it. Like, it's a very, very like high level understanding when everybody's initially starting with that stuff. Where is it airing? Like, cause I remember when it, like you told me once, but I want to make sure that I can be able to see it again.
It's on Cottage Life.
Cottage
in
Life.
Canada.
Okay.
So that's the network that you can view it through if you're in Canada. It has not aired yet in the United States. Ooh. I think they're working on that. And then it just aired in the UK. I don't remember the name of the network though.
That's easy enough. You know, we're not in the UK.
Yeah.
Hey, figure it out. Wild Pacific Rescue, find it from there. When you were on, is there like one rescue that they like highlighted when one of the three episodes that you would deem like the coolest, the most interesting?
Oh gosh, it's hard to remember everything.
No,
I mean, it's nice. So they kind of followed for the seals, just two seals that came into the rescue center and their journey while at, from like coming in to release, which was really neat. Because I was there on one of the first days that the seal got there. So you become really familiar with them. And then they did quite a few sea lion disentanglements. And I don't think people really, like you said, understand everything that actually goes into that. Like they have to coordinate the boats, and then you have to anesthetize the animal while you're cutting the plastic off. And it was really interesting to watch. And I've never actually been on one of the sea lion disentanglements. I've seen pictures and heard about it, but it was really cool to actually watch it happen.
Well, and especially if you did that last summer, you had spent so much time at that point, like actually researching a lot of this stuff. Cause even when you were like, I'm pretty sure for your undergrad, you did a thesis on transient killer whales. And as we love, for those of you who don't know, seals are the prey of transients, as well as many others, of course.
It's a bit ironic or hypocritical, I guess, that I research transient killer whales and I volunteer at Marine Mammal Rescue. So I save the seals, put them, release them back into the sea, and then transient killer whales primarily prey on the harbor seals.
One might just call you a meal prepper.
that's a bad way to look at it.
That's a real, that is rough. I gotta say, every time that anybody says, because I've been watching to Alex in Wonderlust, I only know her as that, Alexandra something. She is like a director on Searching for Chinook, but she posted a little series on Instagram recently where they're doing rehabilitation for turtles and other things like that. And whenever I hear like, oh, a seal or a turtle gets checked in to or like one of these facilities, like all I can imagine is like an animated cartoon of like a seal going up, hi, like can I get an appointment for this? How do they end up finding them and like bringing them in?
Yeah. So a lot of it is just people, it's primarily just people calling in. Okay. If they see like because the majority of patients that come in are baby harbor seals, essentially. Fair. So it would be people seeing it on a beach. They'll call it in, and then we just kind of monitor it to make sure that mom's just not out getting breakfast or dinner for the baby.
Nice.
But a lot of the cases that come in at MMR are human interference. So people picking up the seals if they see a baby seal. And then we have to take it into the rescue center because they've then taken it away from mom, right? Yeah. So a lot of cases come down to that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's mainly people just seeing them. Same with like the sea lions, and we have a northern fur seal in right now.
Yeah.
And so it's just people seeing them injured, or if they wander onto their properties on like the island or anything. And
Hey, I don't know. It's like trespassing line is the marine mammal.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's exactly. That's when people touch them. Cause I know with baby chicks or with like baby birds, if you touch them, then the mother, like, it's done. Like the connection is no longer there. She doesn't recognize the child. Is that the same with seals?
I don't actually know. That's a really good question. I think the biggest thing that happens is that people think it's a really cute seal. So they'll pick it up and move it. And then if mom goes back to the same spot and she can't find it, or she may be scared off if there's a lot of people surrounding the baby and will be resistant to go back to it.
Terrifying.
Yeah.
That's one thing about like that area too, the Pacific Northwest. For their, this is in like Vancouver, and I'm going to guess the Pacific Northwest region specifically, but there's like all of the beaches from North Vancouver down, they're highly populated most times. Like there's very few like long stretches of land that I've found that like doesn't have something going on, so to speak.
Yeah, either like people hanging out there or just industrialization. It's a very populated area now, for sure.
No, it's a lot. It's a lot. All right, so bring it back to your research. So you graduated last year with a BSc, I'm pretty sure honors, if I'm right?
So I was in land and food systems.
Oh, really?
So yeah, so it is a BSc. It was in applied animal biology.
Gotcha.
The honors program is a little bit different there. So it was with honors.
I see.
But you don't have to, be in honors to do a thesis in LFS compared to other faculties.
Nice. How did you end up? One, what was your thesis on? And two, how did you end up getting there?
Yeah, so my thesis was on transient killer whales, so the same as what my master's is on. I wanted to look at the abundance and distribution of transient killer whales. So transient killer whales are kind of the lesser known killer whale in BC, I would say. There's a lot of talk about the residents, and more people are starting now to talk about the transients, or Biggs killer whales are also known as. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to look at in the inside waters of Vancouver Island, so rather than the outer coast. So that's Salish Sea, Strait of Georgia, and all the way to the northern point of the Vancouver Island. Where are transient killer whales actually hanging out? How much of their population is spending time in this area? Mm-hmm. And are they present in this area year round? Sure. So that's what I was looking at for my undergrad thesis, and it was just I was only looking at 2017 and 2018 data.
Gotcha.
For that one. So yeah, so it was a shorter period. Yeah, and how I kind of got involved in it, I took a class at UBC in my, would have been my third year, mm-hmm. and it was research methods and applied biology. So the whole point of the class was to be mentored by a researcher, and you kind of took on a small piece of their research project just to learn what actually goes into the scientific process.
Yeah.
Well, I was really lucky and I ended up working with Dr. May Sato.
Okay.
And she was with UBC Marine Mammal Research Unit at the time. She was a research associate for them.
Yeah.
And so she was looking at abundance and distribution of different fish species in the Salish Sea. So I helped her on that. And she's who kind of introduced me to Andrew Trites, my now supervisor. Mm-hmm. And that's how it all kind of started.
That's crazy. I remember seeing May because they came out with a video a little while back. And I remember her with Sam or the fish research in particular when she started out with that. How did you end up getting in contact with her?
It was just honestly a lot of luck. So you're responsible in the class to find your own researcher to work with. Some will come in and if they need help with their project, they'll give a presentation. Mm-hmm. I was put in contact with May from somebody actually at Marine Mammal Rescue, who was also a former UBC graduate. So she put me in contact with May Sato. While I was waiting to hear back from May, I kind of just cold called them. So I took my CV and I went into the AERL building at UBC and went to Andrew Trites's office and just said that like I needed a research mentor for a class and if he had anybody or knew of anybody. And that's ended up working out for me, thankfully.
That's fantastic. No, definitely. And that's one of the things too. It's like, but that one of the things I found with UBC at the very least is that if you put in the like three steps, usually luck will end up finding you along the way.
Yeah. And like I've this past year I've TA'd for some classes and like what I tell all of like the students that I've had is it really comes down to like building those connections with people. So you have to put yourself out there, build those connections and like that's how I ended up in the position that I'm in right now, just through the people that I met. Mm-hmm. And that's my biggest recommendation to all of them who always ask me.
How do you get there? How do you become Taryn?
Yeah, exactly. Right.
I love it. How did you get into, so if you went into applied biology and LFS, like I'm going to go even further back now. How did you start on that process? Cause this is, it seems like it's a long time.
It is. So I actually have a very long road to get to UBC. So I actually graduated high school in 2012.
Okay.
So I graduated in 2012 and I wanted to be a musician. So, So I wanted to go to school for music.
Okay.
But then the summer before college and university was supposed to start, I decided I didn't want to do that anymore. Okay. So I ended up going to business school instead.
Yeah.
Very similar, right?
so close, right?
Yeah.
Not a question.
So I went to business school for a couple of years and it kind of got to a point in business school where I had to pick what major I wanted to do, whether it be like accounting, management, marketing. And that's kind of a point where I took a step back and realized that there wasn't one thing that was drawing me to it. Like I wasn't passionate about marketing or finances or anything.
Like the idea of business was cool.
Yeah. And I was kind of, I thought it was like a good general thing to just know in life.
Yeah.
And I thought I could figure it out along the way. But at that point I realized maybe this isn't the best fit for me right now.
Makes sense.
So I took a year off. I went traveling and worked with a few friends. Mm-hmm. And then I decided, and it was kind of one of those things that everyone else knew, but I never clued into that I wanted to work with animals. So I decided I wanted to work with animals after my year off. Mm-hmm. I'd worked for many different animal organizations since like grade 11.
Yeah.
And I'd always had this big love for animals.
Okay.
So that's when I found the UBC Animal Welfare Program.
All right.
Just by like Googling and looking stuff up. And I decided that I wanted to go there. But I still, at that point, this would have been 2014. I made this decision, I think.
Yeah.
2014, 2015. But when I was in high school, since I was in music and was planning to be a musician, I hadn't taken any of my science courses.
Oh, that's rough.
So I had to go back and upgrade. So I had to do like all of my chemistry, physics, biology, everything. And then I finally applied to UBC and started in UBC in 2016.
Okay. That's a wild story. What music or what was it in music that you were looking to study? Was it a singular instrument or was it something a little bit broader?
Yeah. So I was a drummer, actually. Very
nice.
Shocking. Yeah. Looking at me, you would not guess that I was used to play the drums.
Oh, that's fantastic, though.
Yeah, so they were a ton of fun, and I wanted to go in to like pursue music as a career, so be a musician, either a music teacher. Musical therapy was a big thing at that time. But I ended up playing for a big orchestra in Canada, and that's when I decided that I don't think it was really the fit for me. It was super competitive.
I would imagine.
Yeah, because I mean, you think musicians, like jobs for musicians, there aren't that many.
No, well, also too, like for those kinds of stuff, I can only imagine like there's only so many and there's like a ton of people that are trying to do it.
Exactly. Yeah. And I was from a really small town and I didn't really get the full grasp of everything until I went and played in this orchestra. And then at that point decided it wasn't for me. It was more of just a side passion kind of thing.
I'm impressed genuinely that you were able to pursue it far enough that you got to the, like, I would call it, so to speak, end, because in my head, once you're in an orchestra, you can kind of like, I can grow my network now and have it set up. But you go like, that's amazing that you got there and were like, okay, no, we're going to reassess. I give you a lot of props for that, because not a lot of people can make it to that degree of something and then decide to switch.
Yeah. And it was tough because I'd applied to all these music schools and gotten in, and that was kind of my plan. Mm-hmm. And then I'm sure my parents loved me when in June I was like, yeah, I don't want to go anymore. I want to do something else. So it was tough because all of the like applications to universities had closed at that point. It was starting in 2 months, and I decided that I didn't want to go. So I just went to a community college near my hometown and worked my way up from there.
Fair. That's fantastic. One of the things that I've like over my couple years, because initially I thought I was going to go into some semblance of research and then found geography and gone from there. But watching what I want to do change over time has been something that's always been interesting, because I've seen some people go straight through. But even looking at the animal welfare program, was there a point where you switched? Because the Marine Mammal Research Unit is not the same explicitly from that.
Yeah. So like I said, I used to work for a bunch of animal organizations like the BCSPCA, and that's kind of, I was very passionate about animal welfare. And so I went into UBC thinking that's what I wanted to go into as my field. I'd always had this love of marine mammals. Even though I grew up on a lake.
Nice.
No marine mammals.
No, not quite that far.
But I would like come to the Vancouver Aquarium when I visited family here. And I'd always had this love for marine mammals. But as I went through UBC, I was kind of told that it's really hard to get into marine mammal research and anything really. So I kind of had put it on the back burner and was looking at other options. And I honestly didn't ever really know what my end dream job was really going through UBC. I just knew it wanted to revolve around animal welfare, animals of some kind. And hopefully research is what I learned in like third and fourth year when I got to take those research-based classes.
Yeah. Well, then I'm giving you like all of the applause in the world right now, because you're sitting exactly where you should be then.
I'm honestly, I feel like I'm the luckiest person to be here. And it's just being in the right place at the right time, meeting the right people.
Also
I got
putting in the right
so many
work.
Opportunities.
No, without a doubt. Well, because like there's only, I know I took a bunch of science courses coming up, but it was chemistry in my first year of university that kind of took me off the path of science in particular. And to go back and like finish high school courses in order to get into the science department, it also shows the drive that you'll have to get to a place where you want to be.
Yeah. Like, and sincerely. It was tough because at that point I would have been like 21, I think. So I was 21 taking high school courses,
yeah.
Which was, fun. That's a good word for it. And then when I started at UBC, I was 22. So whereas most people are starting when they're like 17, 18.
Yeah.
I was already 22 at the time. So
when you came in, did you go into first year housing or did you immediately try to go somewhere else?
No. So I felt like I was a little too old to go and live in the residences there.
Fair.
I actually had family. I have a lot of family that live in Vancouver. So I was lucky enough to live with an aunt throughout 3 years of my undergrad, which was very lucky in Vancouver, especially.
Shout out, auntie.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's phenomenal. No, that's more than fair. Where did you end up doing? Did you go back to whatever high school to finish the courses or was there somewhere else that you
didn't? Yeah. So you can upgrade any high school courses at like colleges.
Oh,
so okay. I was living in Kelowna at the time.
Nice.
So I just did my high school sciences, usually at night classes, at Okanagan College in Kelowna.
Gotcha. Also, Kelowna's beautiful. It's my first stop. My buddy and I, we went up two years ago, May. Because one of his friends worked at, you know, Mission Hill Winery?
Yeah, yeah.
So she worked at Mission Hill Winery, and we've been itching to get back up there since. So as soon as I land, because right now, for those of you who don't know, I think it's June 25th when we're recording this. I'm going to get back like early July, and then I think that weekend or the weekend after that, we're going up because it's, oh my God, I need to see the interior again.
Kelowna's a great summer place. It's right on the lake. You can just go boating. There's so many wineries. Yeah.
Masterful.
Great place to be in the summer.
Yeah. Okay. So you were working with May as your research mentor in the third year class with fish research, so to speak, because that was what she was doing. So you're helping her out with that. How do you make the jump from there to transients?
Yeah. So when I met May, I did the research with her for a semester for the class.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was extremely lucky and she asked me if I wanted to work as a research assistant on her research trip in the summer. That was a month-long trip on a boat looking at the northern resident killer whales and the southern resident killer whales.
Yep.
And looking at prey availability for both. So in that case, the northern residents, their population, there's more than 300 of them. They're thriving. Mm-hmm. They're doing great. Whereas as many people know, I'm sure with the southern residents, they're not doing as well.
Mm-hmm.
Only about, I think it was 75. There may be a couple new calves.
Last time I checked.
Individuals in that population. So that research project really aimed to see what is the issue. Is it actually fish?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people speculated that it was, but we wanted to actually collect the data, take a look and see if that was actually the issue. That was kind of maybe the difference between these two populations. And then also see how the different, both populations of whales behaved.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you were working closely with May on that trip specifically then.
Yeah. So she asked me if I wanted to be a research assistant for her on that trip. And she was responsible for the hydroacoustics. So really what that means is we had this big pole that would go into the water and it sends these signals down, emits like a sound, and it'll record and show us on a screen everything that's below that pole. So it's kind of like taking a window and seeing what's directly below the boat. So we could see how many fish, what size the fish were. Like if you've ever been in a boat, just recreationally boating, it's like a fish finder, sounder. You can usually see the bottom of the lake or ocean or whichever.
Yeah,
but this one's just very highly tuned that it can actually pick up everything between the boat and the ocean floor.
That's phenomenal. No, that's super special. With that, so actually I have a bunch of questions about this trip in particular because it fascinates me. Also, too, have you ever seen Free Willy 3?
I was trying to remember this last night, actually. I don't think I've seen Free Willy 3 because, fun fact, the boat that we were on is called the Geek Me. So I went on this trip for 2 years this past summer in 2020 and in 2019.
Yeah.
And the boat that we were on, the Geek Me, is where they filmed Free Willy.
I knew it.
Yeah. So they filmed the wild whale shots of Free Willy on this boat. And it was actually the first whale watching boat ever in BC.
Was that one must have been up in Telegraph Cove then?
It was. So it belonged to Jim Borrowman.
Oh my. The history in here is real. People, wow. This is phenomenal. Because I can remember when I think it was posted on the Marine Mammal Research Unit's like Instagram page, like I recognized the boat. I was like, it looks extremely familiar. I didn't realize that it was Jim Borrowman's from all the way in Telegraph Cove though.
Yeah.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah, so Jim Borrowman used to own it with Bill McKay, who now does whale watching out of Port McNeil. And it was the first whale watching boat in BC. And then a few years ago, Jim sold it to its now owner.
I love it. That's fun. That's so cool. No, that's I'm getting excited just thinking about that. So the reason that I brought up Free Willy 3 specifically is because, too, they leave out of the Port of Vancouver in the movie. For their research trip.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. When they went, it was so cool because I was watching it like pseudo recently because I did like a watch party with some of my followers. And they like pan when he's like running down, when Jesse's running down the dock and he's bringing pizza, whatever. And you can see the Granville Island or the Granville Bridge and like the city on either side. So I'm like, I know where that is now. I haven't seen it in that long.
That's really cool. I don't think I must not have ever seen Free Willy 3 because I don't remember that, but it's definitely on my must watch list now. I want to see that.
No, for sure. Okay, so you were on there on that research or that trip with May and especially the one afterwards as well. Who else is on that boat?
Yeah, so the first year, if I remember correctly, I think there were 9 of us on this boat. And so it's very close quarters. You share a bed with someone. There's only one bathroom for all of us.
So fun.
Very fun. So I think there was 9 of us. We all kind of had different jobs. So we had the big boat and then we had a smaller boat that we would tow with us that would then go out to the whales.
Okay. So I can remember there's like, was anybody from the BC Cetacean Sightings Network with you? Or was it just the Marine Mammal Research Unit?
Not necessarily just Marine Mammal Research Unit. There were 4 of us from Marine Mammal Research Unit. So myself, May, Dr. Sarah Fortune, she was the one who was kind of leading the killer whale behavioral part of the study.
Okay.
And then Andrew Trites, who was the project head. There was the captain of the boat and his deckhand who was also on the boat. And then we also had the driver for the other small boat.
Yeah.
And then we had a drone flyer who was provided from Hakai Institute. Okay. And we had one other person who was also going out to see the whales.
Interesting.
And I think that's everyone. And I think that's 9 people.
I think that's 9 people. I'm trying to count over here to try to see, but I would imagine so. No, that's phenomenal. Also too, the drone shots. I think that's like one of 3 trips maybe that I've seen that go out and actually do, or not only do, but are allowed to do drone footage, mind you, of the orcas whenever they're going.
There's a lot of permitting that has to be done to fly around whales. And then you also have to be in a lot of correspondence with the surrounding airports too, right?
For sure.
Lots of beautiful drone shots. And one of my jobs that I learned partway through the first trip and then my full job for the second trip was actually catching the drone.
Oh.
So when you think of, when you like fly your drone from land, you just usually press a button that's like come home and it'll fly itself back. Mm-hmm. But when you're on a boat and you're moving, if you press come home, that's going to be way behind where you actually are now.
Yeah.
So instead the drone flyer has to fly it directly into your hands and then you grab it.
That's insane. How easy / hard, like how many times did it get to like really like, oh no, I can do this no problem, do you think?
It's a sketchy job sometimes.
Well, also the propeller's got to be huge.
They're huge and like it has to be flying until you're holding it.
Yeah.
But I mean, you also have to think a boat is not a stable place to stand.
No.
We're going to be in a lot of swell. And
especially in like the Puget Sound area.
Yeah, Puget Sound. And I mean, both years we ended up going really far up North Island into the open ocean. The swell can be huge up there. And yeah. So you're like trying to balance yourself to be able to catch this drone. I have to wear like a helmet and all the safety precautions. So it
definitely
makes it a bit harder to see.
Just a tad.
Yeah. And then you just hold your arms out and then you can usually tell when it's at a safe place to reach out and grab.
Gotcha.
I wouldn't say there's like a point where I was like, oh, I'm good now, because yeah, it really depended on the wind, the swell.
Yeah.
One time the drone came back and it only had one handle to catch. The other one had fallen off.
So great. That one's sounds like a different experience every time, it sounds like, more than
yeah, you kind of never really knew what you were going to get back. But and that's like the drone would usually be up in the air for about 20 minutes.
Okay.
And if anyone's ever been on the water, you know that conditions can change very quickly within 20 minutes. So
not a question.
You may send it up. And it could be beautiful and sunny and calm, but then when it's time to bring the drone back and you can't just abandon the drone, you have to bring it back.
Yeah.
It could be way different.
Damn. That's awesome. It's more than fair. And I like find it hysterical too, that they hired a specific drone person from Hakai. Like, oh no, this is your entire job. It's necessary.
Yeah. I mean, he's amazing at it. He really is. And like, some of the footage that he got is just, it's like breathtaking to be able to see the whales from above. It's a very difficult skill to master.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of training.
Yeah. Like you said, with the variability and as well. What's his name, by the way?
So his name's Keith Holmes.
Keith Holmes. Okay. No, he wasn't who I was thinking then. Interesting.
Yeah, so shout out to Keith for his great drone flying.
Keith, you're killing the game, man. Don't stop. Don't ever stop. You guys also got underwater shots, if I'm right.
We did.
Was that like somebody on the boat? What was that like? You have to hire somebody to do that specifically? Is there like an underwater whale guy?
kind of. So how we got the underwater shots is there would be a large tag-like sort with suction cups. Mm-hmm. So it would be put on the whale. And then that's what would record the video. So awesome. It's a super quick process where you just go up with the whales. It's a 25-foot pole, so you're still quite far away from them.
Definitely.
We had really experienced boat driver who drove the boat. He's been a whale watcher. He knows how to drive around whales and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously we had all of the permitting that was necessary. And so yeah, the whales, you would just wait for them to come up to take a breath, pop the tag on, and they would just continue in stride. It's kind of like the equivalent, like if you got like poked at a grocery store randomly, where you may be like, what was that? But then keep on going.
Mm-hmm.
No behavioral changes, which was great.
And you can tell like from above, you could tell all of that.
Exactly. And that's what we were watching for, especially the first year, just to make sure that this was not doing any negative to the whale.
Definitely.
And especially like as someone who I really value animal welfare, that was my background. It's like, I feel fully confident in it. And then the tags would just come off themselves. So we didn't have to like go in again. It was just a one and done.
Perfect.
And they're about the size of like a shoe or like a novel kind of. So they're pretty large.
Yeah.
In size, and that's where the camera was. So
gotcha. The
camera would be attached to the side of the whale, so you kind of got to see underwater from the whale's point of view.
That's fantastic. For YouTube, I'll definitely post a link to, I'm pretty sure you guys put it on YouTube as well and a couple other places, so I'll link to that. And then I think I might try to like tag you guys on Instagram to send people that way, because those are also amazing shots.
Yeah. So I think there's two of the underwater videos. Actually, no, I think there's more than two. There was one with a bunch of dolphins swimming around the whales, which was really cool to see, just to see how the dolphins actually interact with them.
Mm-hmm.
And something really interesting, like as a researcher looking at that, transient killer whales eat other marine mammals.
Yes.
Including dolphins. So how do the dolphins know that this is a resident killer whale instead of a transient killer whale?
They because do not they wouldn't have the be Jaws bugging. Music behind them.
Yeah, exactly. They wouldn't be bugging the transients, let's just say. But yeah, so we saw a lot of dolphin in some of the videos that are posted.
Yeah.
There's one video. One of the things we saw a lot was like a lot of touching between the whales. A lot, they're very tactile.
Yeah.
So in one of the videos, there's a mom rubbing her calf's belly as they swim, and it was adorable.
Oh, I bet. I bet. For listeners who aren't exactly sure, let's say, what's the difference between a transient and a resident whale? If you had to describe it.
So transients, the biggest difference is their diet. Transient killer whales eat other marine mammals. Mm-hmm. So commonly harbor seals, Stellar sea lions, California sea lions, they will eat porpoise, dolphins, sometimes juvenile like humpback. So they eat mammals, whereas the resident killer whales are the fish eating. So those are the ones who will primarily eat Chinook and other fish species. So that's the biggest difference between them diet wise is the easiest way to kind of explain it.
Yeah.
But then there's also a lot of behavioral differences. So the residents are who you will see grouped up a lot. So if you see the residents, you'll usually see at least 20 of them kind of at one time.
Yeah.
Whereas with the transient killer whales, they don't travel in large groups. There will commonly be 2 to 6 of them.
Yeah.
I think the biggest group ever seen was 40 of them. And that is like a once in a lifetime thing.
You'll
whereas with
that.
The residents, yeah, the residents, that's pretty common to see like a super pod.
For sure.
So yeah, and then you can see physical differences between them. The transients are usually a lot more scarred up on their bodies. They'll have nicks in their dorsal fins just because they eat marine mammals. It's a bigger fight to eat that than a fish.
Yeah.
And then their saddle patches, so the white patch that's just below their big dorsal fin on their back, it can look a bit different between the two species.
Yeah, no, that's massive. I remember when I first started getting into it, they were like whenever you hear killer whales being like, oh my God, they're hunters. They're insane. They have all these techniques in order to really like mess with all of their prey. That's where I usually point people towards the transients more than anything else. It's like, it's not all of the killer whales, but there are sections.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's nonprofit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
Yeah. I mean, last year when we went on the boat, it was in the middle of COVID.
Yeah.
So we just got really lucky in that we had to get a ton of approval from everyone, like UBC, government, everything. And we got really lucky that COVID cases were a bit lower in the summer in BC last year.
Yeah.
And so we had to quarantine for 2 weeks. Everyone on the boat quarantined for 2 weeks before going on the boat. And then we were not allowed off the boat once we were on.
That makes sense. When you guys were on the boat, you were on the boat for a month fully both times.
Yeah. So the first year it was nice because you could get off and walk around different places.
Okay.
Yeah, we were allowed to go do some sightseeing while we were at different places. But last year, due to COVID, we were on the boat for a month straight.
What was the hardest part about being on the boat for that month? Because 9 people in one space, even I was with 3 for the majority of this year, but on the water, something different.
Well, if you think about boats, most boats don't have laundry machines.
Oh, fine.
So there was a very, very small washing machine and dryer on the boat.
Okay.
You could do like a few pairs of socks and a t-shirt at a time.
Yep.
But most of us, like, you would go 2 weeks without doing laundry. So we were a great smelling group.
Oh, I bet. That's how. Well, also too, this is where you're talking like it's luck or anything like that. As soon as you spend a month on a boat with somebody like Andrew, you get to know him pretty well.
Yeah.
you get to mess around. You're like, you can't talk about research for a month straight. And then more than that too, it's like, okay, like, dude, you've been here for too long, whatever. It's like, I can only imagine all of the...
Yeah, no, you form a lot of relationships. And I mean, you get really close with those people because they're the only people you have, like, you're spending time with for a month straight. And a lot of places we go, we don't even have self-service, right?
I was going to say, no chance.
Yeah, so you're just talking to these people. We played a ton of games, lots of board games and stuff. And then, you get to form really strong relationships. And, like, I'm really lucky again. I keep saying this, but I just feel so lucky. Like my now supervisor, Andrew. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have such a great relationship with him that I think a lot of students and their supervisors probably don't have.
Yeah.
Just kind of on another personal level after spending a month for the past 2 years each summer together.
No, that's phenomenal. And like that, the humbleness that you bring to it, it makes everything that you're doing even better, I gotta say. It means that you're doing it for one, the right reasons, but two, it's like, with that support, I can only imagine the research that you do becomes better because it's like, it's uninhibited. Whenever you ask questions or do otherwise, it's like, oh, I'm not getting this. Or like, can you help me out with X, Y, or Z? It's like, I can see the support being even more so there than it would be otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel so supported by everyone in my lab at UBC. I think we have a really great cohesion between everyone. But it's important to be able to feel comfortable to ask those questions, especially as like a woman in science, which is something that's being talked about a lot more now.
Definitely.
There's fewer of us. It's nice.
No, women in STEM, we're all here for it. Mm-hmm. I had one more. Okay, so the board game, I just want to go back to real quick. The board games, was there like, because you did this for 2 years, was there a game when everybody came back that you guys were all excited to play?
I don't know if everyone was excited. I was really excited for one of them because I did really well in it the year before. oh my gosh, I'm blanking. Oh, Love Letters, that's what it's called.
Okay.
I don't know if you've ever played. Yeah, I highly recommend Love Letters to anyone listening. It's really fun.
Yeah.
I got really good at it first year. And then I was like, we got on the boat second year and I was like, anyone want to play Love Letters?
Up and ready. What's the point of the game?
There's different cards. So there's different cards and there's different royalty like people, I guess, on each card. So the goal of the game is to end up with the princess card.
Interesting.
But then each card has like a different feature of what it can do. So like the king, you can look at someone else's card, or like the prince, you like stop someone's turn or something like that.
Gotcha.
So goal of the game is to end up with the princess, but it was really fun. And then we also played a lot of, I don't know if you've ever played, I think it's called Code Names.
Yep.
Yeah, that was a fun one, but it was my first time playing with a group of scientists. And so it's just like another level of intelligence where I'm like, I don't even know what this means. Like,
you had to be, now that I think about it, you had to be one of the youngest people on the boat as well by like a good deal, if I had to guess.
Yeah, the first year I was the youngest person probably by like 10 years. Second year, Mei Sato could not join us on the trip. So someone replaced her, and she was similar to my age.
In the first year, how was it intimidating to walk on? Had you, especially, I know you were familiar with Mei Sato at the time, but with everybody else, that's kind of a, it's a pretty heavy crew to kind of like step on board with, so to speak.
Yeah, I was, very nervous, and I kind of accepted my role as like the bottom of the totem pole, and like I would do whatever anyone needed me to do, but I mean it didn't end up being like that, obviously. Like, everyone's super respectful and it was great, but no, it was really intimidating, and like I'd never spent any time with Andrew at that point, or these other big huge researchers.
You guys met before you got onto the boat, like the everybody that was going to be on there for the month?
No.
So you like, you walk onto the boat, you're like, hi, we're going to be spending a month together as of right now.
Yeah, you're like, hi, I'm Taryn. By the way, we're sharing a bed.
Oh, so fun. Wow. Yeah, that's special. They don't tell you about that during research.
I had met three people prior to getting on the boat.
Yeah, and a nice that third.
Was it. Yeah.
A nice third of the people.
Yeah. So yeah, everyone else was new to me, but then the second year it was mostly the same people returning, a couple of new people. But I definitely felt way more comfortable at that point.
Oh, I bet. I bet. That's one of the things I really like about this community as well, is that anytime I've walked in, even I know I've talked with Andrew a couple of times, it's like, as intimidating as any might be from afar, as soon as you actually get to talking with them, everybody's like nice and looking to help, as far as I'm concerned, or looking like they're not as intimidating as they seem.
Yeah. And everyone loves to talk about research, everything happening, and just like killer whales in general. So it's nice.
No, that's phenomenal. When did we first talk? Cause it was, had to have been, it was 2020 when COVID started. So it was like winter of 2019. Cause that was the Marine Mammal Research conference.
Yes. Yeah. And I think we talked last spring.
Yes.
I was just finishing up, I think, my undergrad thesis.
And we were taught, because that was with Andrew in the computer science department for whatever it was. Yeah. So that was that. When you were, I remember the last time we talked though, you were like pouring through data sheets, or not data sheets, photos of transients. So if you were photo IDing on the second trip, was that also with Northern residents?
Northern and Southern, so with my undergrad thesis, I had to go through thousands of photos of transients and ID them. So I got really good at IDing, which was like, I guess a good skill to have. I don't know how useful it is in the real world, but
Well, as of right now, research is the real world as far as like where you're enveloped.
Yeah, that's true. So yeah, and then I got to, it was beneficial obviously, because I put that skill to use on the second year of the cruise. I just kind of got a knack for being able to ID and what to look for really quickly.
Good stuff.
And so I was one of the IDers for last year, and then I was kind of just like the jack of all trades. Like, if somebody needed something to be done, I would do it.
You've got it set.
Yeah.
No, I was gonna say too that all of that transferable, there's not too many people where you've asked them like, oh, like, can you catch a drone that's created for research? Like, that's not a skill that everybody has in their back pocket. You can't really go to the class for that.
Definitely not. No. And yeah, it was a ton of fun and just learning everything. And it's a lot of expensive equipment, so you learn to be very careful. And
I bet even more so. Your screen probably hasn't cracked in a while then. Even just as soon as you come back, it's like, I can see that expanding into other areas.
Yeah. Just every time I caught the drone, it's like, I don't care what happens to me. Just don't drop the drone. Don't drop the drone.
No, more than fair. So when you were IDing, and this will be like one of the wrap-up questions too, is there any whales that you were so happy to see because they were so easy to ID for the transients?
For like during my master's, looking at the photos?
Yes.
Yeah. So the transients, there are a few individuals who are very easy to ID. Mm-hmm. So there's Chainsaw. I'm sure if anyone's ever heard of transients, they've probably heard Chainsaw's name. Very well-known transient killer whale, has huge bites out of his dorsal fin, essentially, hence the name Chainsaw. There's also a transient killer whale who is white. So T46B1B. Don't know his name that has been given to him.
Gotcha.
But yeah, he is kind of like an albino type of killer whale. It's called Lucent. But yeah, he is white, and it's my dream in life is to see this killer whale. And we were so close on the boat last year. They were so close to us, but we had to get to our spot where we were anchoring for the night. So
That's too bad.
We miss them. But yeah, there's a lot of transients who are quite, you kind of, after you do it for a few individuals, you get to recognize them really easily, and you'll just be able to go through photos and be like, oh, that's T2C. Oh, that's awesome. T99. Like, yeah.
So I always found this really cool, and I think everybody else or anybody listening would actually really appreciate it. So T46B1B.